Welcome to the Boost Podcast with me, Graham Farmer, and today I welcome an absolute legend of the dance music scene in Jody Wisnoff. Jody, alongside Nick Warren, formed Way Out West many, many years ago, an iconic dance music group. He's since gone solo and is a prolific studio producer and DJ, having released countless singles, one studio album, and seven installments of the Induna Deep compilation series. I chatted to Jody at the beginning of lockdown about his new album, about his production techniques, and we talked about drums a lot. He also gave his five tips that every producer needs to know. It was a really interesting chat. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed chatting to Jody. Let's dive into this. Hey, Jody, how you doing?
Yeah, good, mate. How are you? Okay?
Yeah, good, man. Thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, I've obviously been aware of you for a long, long time. And I'm sure you used to play at Turnmills when I used to work at Turnmills. I'm sure.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I seem to remember Way Out West nights right back then. And
yes, mate. God, yeah, that was a very interesting venue, to say the least. So strange seeing the building, like, not being a hive of, you know, a den of iniquity.
Oh, do you know what? Yeah, I've been past it a few times, and like, I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
It's just a building now.
Yeah, yeah. But, don't go there right now, because you feel even stranger.
Yeah, because there'll be nobody about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I got off the tube, because I used to go to work there every day, so I used to go there.
Yeah, man.
Like, I got off the tube to go to Fabric a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, oh, I've not been here in a while either. I've not come off this tube in a while, you know? It's mad.
Mental. Yeah, I'm just hiding away in Bristol, where it's relatively rural, so.
Oh, but yeah. It's nice.
Yeah, it's all right, man.
And for those that are listening on the podcast, your man cave is amazing.
Oh, thank you. Do you want to have a little yeah, swivel?
We'll do a swivel for the ooh, Instagram watchers.
Yeah, little bad boy there.
That's cool.
That's good fun, man. It's nice to have somewhere to hide away and crack on with it.
So for the people that don't know who you are, let's from my audience, because there's a lot of new artists that are listening. So let's just kind of go through your history and
cool,
kind of start at the start, and then let's take it up to where you're up to now, I guess.
Nice. All right. Cool. Yeah. Well, I'm Jody Wisnoff, obviously. I mean, at the moment, I'm predominantly a solo artist. Have been since around 2006. Kind of like the main thrust of everything. But I started out, well, when things actually started to happen, it was Way Out West. So that was me and Nick Warren.
Yep.
That was when kind of like things became serious. Before that, you know, I was doing stuff with my little bro. I was hip hop, doing rave stuff with Die under the name of Sub Love.
Wow.
So yeah, that was like sort of like 1991.
Yeah.
So, but before, you know, going back further, I'll say like 86, that was the hip hop. 86, 88.
Wow.
Hip hop era, yeah. So that was crazy times as well.
That seems mad. Yeah, when did the Way Out West thing start?
93.
Okay, cool. And how did you guys meet? I've never kind of went through this, but
really? Yeah. Okay, Nick used to work in a record shop that I'd kind of scour for breakbeats and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, walking there with my Kangol hat and feeling like a right little b-boy. little white kid from Bristol with a red Kangol, man. I remember going to buy the Kangol from Carnaby Street. It was literally the only place that you could get the, you know, the hat I'm talking about, like the old school hip hop.
Of course, I remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. So me and my little brother got forced our parents to take us up there. Bought four of them at once. It's like, wow.
Were they around Pulp Fiction or wasn't Samuel Jackson wearing them? And then
yes.
Everyone started
pretty
wearing.
Sure. Yeah. That would have been like a second phase of it. Do you know what I mean? I mean, we were like copying Run DMC and LL Cool J and those guys. And
right.
They were actually pretty dodgy hats, like kind of thinking about it now in like retrospect. I think they were like marketed for old ladies, and for some bizarre New York reason, you know, they caught on. But
they were such the rage in the 90s, man. Yeah, everyone was wearing them.
But yeah, but I saw someone busting one the other day, actually. I was like, yeah, man. Bring it back.
They are one of those retro brands that you could just see like pop every now and again, you know?
Totally. It's like you can wear it in an ironic kind of fashion.
Yeah, you'd need like one influencer on Instagram to start doing it, and then all of a sudden they'd just pop again.
Yeah, man. Totally. So, yeah, so began, you know, just messing around with like a four track, a Casio keyboard, like CZ1000 was the first synth I ever had when I was about 15.
Yeah.
Blew my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. Do you remember the ZX Spectrum computer?
Of course.
Exactly. If you said no, I would have turned my computer off right now.
Do you know what? We've still got there's two in my dad's loft.
Wicked, still. Man. Well, the 48K or the...
Yeah, the 48K.
Rubber keys or the hard keys?
Do you know what? We had... Well, there's one that's rubber keys, and I think there's one that's hard keys as well.
Yeah, you had both of them. Posh.
Yeah, and do you know, we had the printer for it as well.
The little black printer.
Yeah, with a little silver roll of paper.
Yes.
Oh my God, you're making me feel nostalgic. Oh my God, yeah. That was a bad boy, wasn't it? So yeah, so the, do you remember Spec Drum? So is it like a drum machine that you'd run on the Spectrum?
No, but that sounds amazing.
It was like a super crusty, like 8-bit, you know, drum. So that was my drum machine of choice. Well, it was that's what I had. So that was kind of, you know, blew my mind at the time.
Amazing.
Casio and a four track. And that was actually it at the very, 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 very beginning. And one record deck, my dad's belt drive, which I kind of hijacked.
Belt drives are always were amazing. Like, you literally trying to mix on a belt drive, it was just impossible. You
know what I mean? I know, we've learned on terrible technology. Do you know what I mean? So if you can mix, if you can scratch with a belt drive, do you know what I mean? Get some grease through Fafer to make it slide. And
is that how you do it? No, man.
That's what, yeah. I mean, the needles got completely annihilated. But yeah, from very humble beginnings, you know, this is where my generation started out, really, with nothing.
That's amazing. I didn't realize you could have that. There was a Spectrum.
Yep, Spectrum is the one. I've actually found the samples the other day on a disc. So it sounds the snare. There's like a snare with the electro kit, and it's spelled Bouash, B-A-B-U-A-S-H. It's basically a sample of the 909 snare. So they rip that and kind of rusted it up a little bit. So it's like, poof, and I was like, yeah. So that's crazy. But yeah, so just started out with that. I remember finding an 808 in a drum shop one time when this is before they were sought after again, so they were still like seen as nothingness.
Yeah.
Managed to buy 100 squid for my dad and scored that, so that was pretty amazing. And I was like, oh my God, this is the drum sounds I was really obsessed, sort of amazed by, like the early LL Cool J stuff, like his first album.
Yeah.
Thing, and Beastie Boys like Paul Revere and stuff like that, early Run DMC. They all had this really, you know, unusual sounding drum machine sound. Marvin Gaye, Sexual Healing. It really like appealed to me when I was a kid, and I've got no idea why. It just kind of drew me in. I was like, this is such a synthetic, unusual, but appealing kind of, you know, frequency that these drum sounds are hitting. Especially the kick. It was like blew me away. So yeah, lucky enough to score an 808 when I was kind of a kid. So that was an incredible thing.
Have you played drums? Have you, like, is that...
I could weirdly... I sort of had natural rhythm at school and could sit behind the kit and kind of play.
Right.
Just in a sort of, you know, smashing out kind of way. But had piano lessons when I was a child, so
helped a lot.
Yeah, I was so glad that my parents forced me to do that at the time. It was like, nah, but yeah. Because it's a very, you know, I've got a basic understanding that's enough to carry through, really. So how about you?
I never have learned any music instruments or production at all. Know a lot about everything else.
Yeah, man. Yeah, yeah.
Music. And yeah, in fact, only just like in the last 2-3 months have made a track.
Nice.
I've sat with someone else, this guy called Hobbs, and we've made this disco track, which is which is actually really bloody cool, and it got signed to Dawley's label. Like,
oh really? Okay, yeah, man.
So it's coming out in the summer, but like he did all of the production-y bits, all of the let's tweak this and let's, and I'm like, yeah, okay, cool, sounds great, but we should be doing, make it sound more like this sort of thing, you know? I was just coming with the ideas and...
That's kind of half the job right there, you know? In some ways, being a conceptualist is equally as important as the studio guy, the techie guy, because, you know, we get sort of blinded sometimes by options and, you know, like option paralysis can be quite dangerous if you step away from that. You know, that's the good thing about working with non-techies heads.
I know lots of music, and that's kind of what I brought to the table with it, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that speaks volumes in itself, really.
And I was like, well, that's why we put this sample with that sample. And you use a lot of samples.
Did you have to anything that you think needs clearing or generally kosher?
Yeah, I think so. I think we're going to be cool, but we'll see.
Just a couple of Madonna samples here, a bit of the Beatles.
Oh no, it's just really, really rare disco stuff. So
yeah, underground.
I will send you it when we finish, and you can have a listen.
Laughs, man. I'd love to hear.
Well, I've gone completely off. But yeah, so...
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah, it's always fun. So yeah, I guess this obsession with drums is... Like, did it start anywhere, or was it just kind of...
It's really bizarre, man. I'm not sure. It's just kind of... came out of somewhere. Maybe just... I think it just appealed to me in a... Yeah, I'm really can't answer that one, but I'm obsessed with drum machines. You know, I'd quite happily just go onto YouTube and, you know, look at drum machine history whilst I'm eating a curry in the evening and feel very, very sad, actually. It really is. It's just like massive loser. I can pick out the sound of the snare drum from a really obscure breakbeat, like if it's in a track, really quietly in the background. I can just detect, you know, these very subtle differences in... essentially just, you know, a skin being hit. It's really odd. I don't know why, but
I guess that's your have you ever heard that thing about 10,000 hours of learning, and you must have done your 10,000 hours on drums and and that's why now you've got this amazing knowledge.
It's a strange one, but yeah.
So this podcast is let's dive into that, because this podcast is obviously designed for tips, so let's pull some knowledge on drums, because I'm guessing a lot of producers don't get it wrong, or need some help on how to improve theirs. What can we give them
when it comes to like programming beats and stuff
like
that?
Just kind of, obviously I guess the drums in dance music is a big part of the part of the track, and getting them right is hard. A lot of people struggle.
Oh, massively. I struggle. We all do. It can be something that you can be quite lucky with the track. Sometimes things can just fall into place. Other times you might be working with the wrong bass drum up until the very, very last minute, but you don't actually realize it's the wrong kick until you change it. You know, and then so, you know, you can, or it's, I don't know, man, it's almost like it can be like the final piece of a jigsaw puzzle so, you know, the track can kind of be complete and then but not be working, and then I mean there's no kind of definite rules around it as well. It's just something that, you know, you kind of pick up as you go along.
Are you making all your tracks hardware based now? A lot of hard drive. You've got a lot of.
Yeah, sure, but I'm still really into, you know, sampling from vinyl sometimes, or, you know, using plugins, blah blah blah. And I'm not against, you know, any of that kind of stuff at all, really. But it is quite nice to make hi hats with analog synths. You know, you can doing the white noise thing and stuff like that. So, you know, but you know, it's not essential at all. So
have you seen a load of these people doing fit, like making tracks from stuff around their house while they've been on lockdown?
Yeah, like fam sound stuff. Just get a little rice shaker.
Yes,
totally.
People making them out of beer bottles. That's quite funny.
Yeah, that's quite, makes, it's quite a nice timbre. Like a kind of
you
nice.
Mentioned samples. What I guess, where are you, like, do you have any hard and fast places you like finding samples, or is it dig YouTube or dig?
Yeah. I mean, you can actually sample from YouTube, and it can, you know, it has sometimes a slightly glassy effect, but, you know, it can work, really. In some ways, it sounds probably cleaner than sampling from old records. So, yeah, I guess, you know, a bit of both, really. You know, you can find a lot of stuff just from, you know, people upload samples that you can use as well. So, you know, this is a wealth of, there's so much accessible stuff compared to, you know, back in the day when, you know, we had to kind of work a lot harder to get it to certain points. But then again, also, that means there's so many options that it equally causes problems. You know what I mean? It's quite nice to try to make tracks with drum sounds that have never been used before as well. That's something that's sometimes a bit of a challenge, but can be an effective thing. You know, staying well clear of any recognizable, you know, famous drum sounds.
And just start from a scratch.
Completely. So, as you said, the found sound thing can be really useful. But then again, there's a reason that these well-known drum sounds work. You know, they make people feel comfortable. You know, they feel cozy when they hear them. So, you know, there's tried and tested things that people naturally gravitate towards.
Yeah, and I guess from a label point of view, they're like, people recognize certain drums and they'll go, yes, that works, and that
definitely
that makes it more a track more signable, I guess.
Yeah, totally. But also my advice is, maybe don't, when you write music, don't have that in mind.
Yeah,
because you're always going to be sort of following, if you're considering what might sell or what might be signable for a certain label, then that's probably not what we're going to want to sign. we've already signed it.
Yeah, so I always think that labels are like, if you're trying to send a track to, because if you've heard a track that the label's put out and then you're trying to send them a similar track, then you're already absolutely 6 months behind where they're thinking now.
But saying that, you know, pretty much everything that I make in the studio, I'm trying to copy something I think is brilliant anyway, so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, completely. Like when I made Cold Drink Hot Girl, which is the first track that I put out sort of under my own name, I was literally trying to copy Body Language by Mandy.
Oh, cool.
In my mind, it was as close as I could get. Like, blatant riff off. It probably sounds nothing like it at all, but that was like the template. So, you know, don't be too precious about things, you know. Like, literally do plagiarize, because it will never sound the same anyway. But that's, you know, I'm not kind of proud in that respect, really. I think it's good to try to...
Yeah, it's good to have a nice base for start with trying to try a copy, and then you'll end up making something completely different, I guess.
Massively. So, you know, you get, just can be very inspiring as well, and, you know, quite disheartening if you're getting nowhere near it. You're like, oh god, you've been doing this for 25 years.
I'm still nowhere near Body Language.
Yeah, exactly. I'll try again in a minute.
And then let's bring it up to date. What are you? I guess you've just got a new album out, but what else are you up to at the moment?
So the album's out, so on the 1st of May, which is will be in a few days, but it will be in the past.
Yes,
is in the past now.
Yeah.
So just kind of right now, I've just got a few remixes on the go, just, you know, using the time of no traveling to the maximum. But to be perfectly honest with you, it's a tricky one, it's a double-edged sword, because we've, as producers, we've suddenly got loads of time to tinker away, but it's the inspiration thing. You know, because we're usually writing music for the weekend, or there's a goal in mind. Do you know what I mean? So it is a tricky one, and I find that I'm kind of grabbing the vibes when they come, and then when I'm not feeling it, almost trying to allow myself to not feel it instead of beating myself up for not feeling it. If you see what I mean?
Yeah, I guess that must be hard, right? You want to make stuff for a dance floor, but you can't. Yeah, there's not a dance floor to.
It's really weird, man. make music for someone's iPhone speaker.
Yeah, how are you? Have you got into the live stream thing yet? Or are you?
I'm starting tomorrow properly. My little live stream setup is getting close. I'm doing a vinyl session tomorrow.
Wow, cool.
Testing Twitch all weekend and making sure it's all smooth. And then doing a biggie on album release day, which will be in the past when this is watched, probably. Yep. So I'm into it. I'm getting into it now. At first, I was kind of, you know, letting other people get on with it and just processing things in my own way.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I'm on it now.
That's cool. I like the vinyl. That sounds cool.
Yeah, that should be fun. Digging out all the few rave classics, bit of hip hop, bit of funk, bit of weird psychedelic stuff that my folks were into.
Nice.
So yeah, it's crate digging for a few hours, basically. So yeah, it should be fun.
And you're going with the Twitch live option?
Yeah, I'm going to use the Andunity account for this, because...
Oh, cool.
I'm actually starting from scratch with Twitch. I've just created an account. Actually, I tried to create an account, but someone's got my name already, which is a bit odd. So can I have my name back, please, whoever's...
Yeah, do you know what? Someone set up the data transmission one for us.
Yeah.
Work for data transmission, but no, I can't get into it.
Is that any? Oh my god!
And do you know what? It's even linked to one of the email addresses, but it's weird. I can't seem to get into it. It's annoying. I've been trying lots.
Weird. As an imposter.
Yes, and so you're working with. Are you doing working with Anjuna as well now? Did I hear?
Yeah, totally, man. We're working on Deep 12 at the moment, so that's the next compilation with James.
Yeah.
Cracking on with that. When we work on the comps with, so a lot of the tracks that are in the shortlist already for 12 were knocking around during the time of 11, you know, there's just kind of such a vast spread of great music that we're getting sent at the moment. You know, it's impossible to fit everything on.
Do you take submissions for that? Can people just send you music?
Yeah, 100%.
The compilations?
Yep, totally.
Oh, that's amazing. And you put loads of new artists on there?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, if they're amazing.
Yeah, of course.
You know, there's definitely a purple patch at the moment for you know, the quality of submissions. Yeah, so working on the next comp with James, and just kind of, Sanning got some amazing stuff already.
How many of those are you doing a year? Do you do
one a year? One a year, roughly.
That's cool.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I remember listening to. I remember listening to 5 and 6. Well, nice. five that we went massive across the whole of the state. Was it 5?
No, 5 was the first one I did actually. That's when they invited me in.
That's the one I remember. Yeah,
I went a little bit feral on that one actually. I decided to re-edit almost every track.
Whoa!
Re-editing Bender, because I felt like it. You know, it was the way to add like a slant to it. You know, obviously Sasha did this years ago with Involver and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I was like, right, okay, I'm going to do a little Involver and get the stems for every single track.
How was that process?
Good fun, man. Took a while. But actually, we'd had a flood, so I was like, we were living in a hotel for 4 months. It was really bizarre. I couldn't use a studio, so I was literally laptop vibes for a while. And yeah, so it kept me busy.
That's cool. I didn't realize you did that. That's cool. Yeah, I remember that album. That's mad. That was one of the first ones I remember that went super huge.
Oh, thank you.
I remember like all the press about it going all the time, going.
Mental, man. That's when we changed direction. That was literally like a conscious effort to, you know, establish our sound as, you know, to differentiate from the style of Anjuna Beats. You know, not just BPM wise, but just the general groove and stuff like that. You know, we just went into this kind of. Yeah. Sexier angle.
Yeah. So now the two brands are very like they've got their own identity, which is, I guess they do that very well. And
definitely, man. Yeah, they're great. Yeah, the team, amazing.
Yes. Yeah. They fully deliver.
Definitely, man.
What 5 things does every producer need to know?
God, 5 things. You need to have some kind of. I think you need to have an identity, so you need to figure out what you need to have a reason for people to listen to you. So, you know, it doesn't, you know, come overnight. So, I suppose something unique
that
can take, you know, you might be quite lucky and you might hit on it sort of early on. You know, some people explode quite quickly, which can be dangerous in itself because, you know, once you've reached those dizzy heights, where can you go from there?
Is that the difference between, I guess, when you're trying to switch from being a DJ, that you're playing a lot of people's records, and then you're trying to be starting to be an artist when you're trying to be like, obviously, you start think like, I guess if you're starting as a DJ and you're playing loads of people, you're going out and playing loads of shows, and then you all of a sudden you go, right, I want to start producing now, and then this is where you need to start thinking of yourself as an artist and that kind of like that space basically.
But it's also, you know, you need to be careful that you don't overthink things because it's almost like, you know, the whole thing should just be natural and, you know, just almost, you know, creative as opposed to thinking about the game plan and stuff like that. So,
yes,
you know, I think there's the two very, very, very different sides of the mind. The probably one's right and one's left. I'm not sure, but they don't really gel that well in my experience.
Yes.
So man. I mean, the other thing, like a lot of people go from, say you're a producer and then you suddenly have to learn to be a DJ. You know, that's the other tricky one that you see a lot.
Yes.
Of and then you've got to kind of, you know, learn these performance skills and, you know, social skills that you might not have had. You know, because classically a lot of studio heads are introverts.
Yes.
So, you know, we all know
they've
that.
They've sat there learning the production.
Yeah.
Go out and perform, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I think that's probably a harder one to deal with for some people.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I guess because if you've been playing to a dance floor, you kind of know what records shape a dance floor a little bit. And
yeah, completely, man. So, and some people are lucky enough to kind of learn the two skills consecutively. So, which was, you know, a lot of people from my generation, that's how it kind of was, really.
Yeah.
You know, we just...
Just did.
They were both the same thing. Completely, man. You know, so... I don't think there's that many DJs that are strictly DJs. I can think of about a handful, to be honest.
I agree with you.
And they usually are fucking amazing as well. So, you know, if you're putting all those eggs into that basket, then...
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's and that, I guess that's the way of the scene though, the moment where you have to kind of produce to get your name and build your brand and whatever.
Yeah, yeah. There's very few people that are lucky enough to be a DJ, full stop.
Yes.
Or not even lucky enough, actually. I mean, I love making music. I wouldn't actually call that lucky. It'd probably, you know, I'd hate not to be spending most of my time in the studio. So it's a form of relaxing. You know, it's almost like meditative in a way. So, you know, I think it's what we do. But yeah. So
okay, number one. That's number one.
Yeah, that's one done.
That's cool. Number two.
As I touched on this earlier, but it's very useful to have a certain degree of classical training. In some ways, you know, I've seen that there's a lot of software at the moment being advertised for like chord generators and, this just things to help if you've got absolutely no knowledge of, you know, the structure of keys and stuff like that.
Yes.
I think they're best avoided. I think your time would be better spent having 6 months worth or a few months worth of piano lessons or something like that, or guitar lessons or whatever. But I think build those skills and use that to your advantage as opposed to use software that cheats. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I've seen a load of them, load of those kind of...
They keep popping up whenever I go on YouTube. It's like, it's the first thing that you know, it's like, go away.
I've actually seen a load of people advertising now that they're teaching piano online as well.
That's nice. That's kind of cool in a way.
In this period, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so that makes sense. But yeah, just kind of... definitely, it's a valuable thing to have a certain degree of musicianship, but not too much, because if you start riffing on a track, it sounds stupid. You know, you don't want to be too technically proficient when it comes to, you know, you still need to, it's more, vibe is still above musical integrity, or not integrity, but ability, in my opinion.
Yeah, you see, that's not that rawness, I guess.
Yeah, definitely, man. You know, you need to remember where this music that we love comes from is people that... probably, you know, made a lot of happy mistakes, and you know, so
yeah, I agree. There's so many great records from happy mistakes.
You know, so like I remember reading reviews from like sort of producers like Marshall Jefferson and these kind of guys from that era of house music, mm-hmm. and they were talking about whenever when they started to do sort of quite well for themselves, there'd be, you know, a lot of, you know, high level commissioned remixes for, you know, Madonna and such, and you know, they'd rent out sort of SSL studios with engineers, and they'd be sort of doing the mix in the studio, but the sound would just be nowhere near as vibey as the sound they're getting at home in their crusty like 8-track studios, you know. So it's, you know, you kind of, you don't want things to be too perfect, and this, I think that's something that we need to carry on even to this day, really.
Yeah, I agree. I saw an image of Daft Punk when they made Homework, and it was like the most basic setup, the most basic setup known to man.
Seriously, man, like the compressors that they use, the Alesis 3630s, got a couple of them up there.
Don't know, oh, if cool.
Yeah, like the shittiest compressor in the world, you know, but there's just something about that kind of, the terribleness that made it really work. About 100 quid a pop. They probably got up in value now, but yeah, completely. I think they had their keyboards on the floor, didn't they? Like kind of,
yes.
It was just a really bad setup, but I just, you know, great, great record.
Yeah, I guess they learnt those pieces of kit inside out, and
completely, man.
That's what they got the most out of them.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, kind of, you know, I suppose keep it, don't polish things up too much, and just, you know, value vibe over perfection.
That's cool. That's nice. No, right. So number three.
Okay. Bring back sampling.
Yes.
Massively. I mean, because it just adds so much character, and especially. You know, just be careful, obviously. You know, you don't want to get your label into trouble. You know, you do need to declare things clear publishing, do replays. You know, that's quite a big thing these days. You know, there's companies that do sample replays, and you know, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But you know, you can, you don't have to be sampling from, you know, from vinyl. You know, YouTube is okay as long as you filter out the nasty frequencies. But yeah, just it's because that's where we're from, you know, because we didn't have, you know, we came from, you know, very humble beginnings. You know, if you had a sampler, you were the man as well, because samplers were really, really, really expensive back in the day. They were like $3,000
for
like 12 seconds. So that's why we value sampling so much, because we invested a lot in samplers. So we're like, right.
You know? Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't realize that was so expensive.
Yeah, they were so pricey, man. They were pricey as hell. But then again, I can completely understand the reason people are against it. You know, it's kind of collage, it's audio theft in some kind of ways. But so, you know, there's two sides to this story, obviously.
I guess if you're clearing a sample, then it's obviously not going to be theft. It's going to swing any, yeah.
Completely. I mean, there's only 12 notes on the keyboard anyway. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're not going to, you can't really claim chord progressions to that insight in many ways as well. It's just like, it's all been done before. But yeah, so I think, you know, sampling is something that isn't done enough in dance music these days. People are just relying too much on, or just using, thinking they, you know, they can just, you know, the quality of soft synths and stuff, it's lovely, it's amazing, but, you know, bring back the crusty raw samples, please.
Yeah, I guess that's got to do something to do with content systems, though, because when you're trying to put up a track and it's got a sample in it, it's going to get taken down by the content system.
True.
And therefore...
Play it backwards.
yeah, play it backwards. There must be things like, good. Yeah, I've learned a lot about it from making this record, about slowing it down or speeding it up, and yes,
yeah,
interesting man. Times with samples. Interesting times.
Definitely. But, you know, because I'm really so fond of the kind of mid-90s jungle sound as well, and, you know, that would have, imagine all the early Bookham stuff.
Yes.
If they were avoiding samplers, you know, it just wouldn't exist.
Yeah, massively. Lots of that drum and bass sound is from that time was definitely, and jungle, yeah.
Yeah, completely. So, yeah.
Okay, number four.
Number four. I think you need to put a lot of time into this. I'd say it needs to be a full-time obsession, not a part-time hobby.
Right.
Because, you know, the 10,000 hour rule thing that you mentioned earlier. Yeah, I kind of do agree with that, you know. And it's amazing. It's really, really, really enjoyable. The journey is actually what it's all about. It's not about the goal.
Yes, agreed.
But, you know, to get to the point where, you know, you're putting stuff out there in this already crowded world, you know, you need to put the hours in and you need to enjoy the hours. If it feels in any way like a chore, if you're dragging yourself into the studio, yeah, I mean, that happens quite often if you've got writer's block and stuff like that. But I'm talking generally, you know, you need to be in the kind of person that wakes up in the morning and thinks about music pretty much within the first 10 minutes of being awake. That's, I think, how obsessed you need to be if you want to have any, if you want to consider this as a profession.
Cracking out a few hours before you go to work and then coming home and just carrying on with it.
Yeah, man. It's got really, you know, yep, we've got things going on in our lives, you know, families, kids, wives, everything, but music has got to be near the top of your priority list.
That's a great one.
Constantly. Do you know what I mean? And if it stops, then time to move on.
Go and get a proper job.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it's an all-consuming thing, and you know, if you're lucky enough to land yourself in that position, appreciate how lucky you are.
It's a great talk.
Because it's an incredible privilege to be able to do this, you know, and especially now with stuff that's going on in the world, I appreciate it even more, big time, you know, because you know you think there's people. You know, we're doing this. This has always been how we identify ourselves, or how, you know, like, okay, I make music, I'm a DJ, blah, blah, blah. Suddenly, it's like, right, actually, is that really true? Do you know what I mean? You need to really look at the big picture here and think, you know, it's intense stuff, man.
Number five.
Yes, number five. I think it's actually quite a nice thing to make music during the daytime, and I used to completely disagree with that. I mean, I was a night owl, you know, back in the day. I was like, you know, kind of, I'd say I was most inspired at 2 a.m. when the phone stopped ringing and blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. I think that's actually a load of bollocks. I think just try to go to bed at a decent-ish time, wake up in the morning, and you can be firing on all cylinders. I think your mind is actually more active in the morning.
Yes, your creative space is much more active in the morning.
Yeah, completely. So don't use. This is an excuse for just staying up all night. It is actually possible to do your hot stuff in the AM.
Yeah, unless, yes. Cool, that was cool.
But yeah, go to bed.
Yes, and go to work.
I've got number six actually as well.
Go on then, go number six.
I find I'm drinking alcohol really doesn't work in a studio for maybe for some things like arrangement and stuff like that. But when it comes to actually coming up with, or even hearing, I think your hearing gets altered by booze. You know, you can definitely lose that kind of real sharp killer instinct. DJing is all right. It relaxes you and makes you dance more like a dad. So that's kind of good vibes. But but yeah, the important stuff in the studio has got to be on very, very sober, I've found, and always believed in. That's just me, though.
So that's cool. Yeah, I agree.
So yeah, do it.
Also, do it drinks around hardware, not great.
Yeah, man. God, yeah. Literally almost spilt red wine on my new laptop yesterday. It was so scary. It was like, Oh my god.
No, I know,
just turn it upside down.
Yeah.
Get a hairdryer.
Yeah, get the rice out.
Yeah, definitely. Does that work?
I think it does. I think it does with phones. I'm not sure. I don't know why.
It's a classic phone thing, isn't it?
Yeah, stick it in rice. I don't know why it works.
Yeah, strange. Housewife's tale.
Yeah, I think it might be.
Yeah, so that's, I don't know, a few little...
That's great. And we had a bonus one. That's great.
Yay, sobriety. Yes. But not behind the decks. It's really boring DJing sober. Oh my God. The occasional time when, you know, you're taking antibiotics and yeah, it lingers. Actually, I played in Salt Lake City a few years ago. And yeah. It's a dry state. So, but no, it's dry in if you're a performer.
Yeah.
So I basically got really, really, really drunk before I started playing and slowly sobered up throughout the set. So I was hammered at the beginning and then like just stone cold sober like 3 hours later.
How did that affect the set?
Backwards. Yeah, I think the mixing got tighter, but the selection got worse, like in equal measures as time went on. Just became cool. More, yeah, super tight, but really conservative. Weird.
Oh, do you find you go a bit more weird with alcohol?
Yeah, definitely. Just kind of start to take a few more interesting risks and chucking curveballs and stuff. Yeah, I'm definitely, when I play by myself, like I absolutely love DJing with James and stuff, but we kind of definitely try to stick to more of an Andrew and the Deep branded sound and stuff like that, you know? And sometimes when I'm doing my own thing, I'll go off on some really weird tangents just to keep myself interested, I suppose.
So, yeah, that's cool.
Some weird choices, but hey.
That's really cool. I always think that people are playing it too safe when they're DJing, and it's too solid and too.
Yeah, man. I think it comes with experience as well. You know, you need to get to a point where you can feel confident about possibly losing the dance floor. But if you play it right and have the kind of correct body language, you can keep people with you. But
yeah,
you know, it's really good fun to take risks.
Play that record that's a lot slower than the one you're just playing and
massive tempo drop just like at peak time. Actually, me and James ended, we played at Printworks last December and our last track was like 60 BPM.
Wow.
Yeah, for like 5 fucking minutes. Yeah, this is at peak times, so I think it was like 9 PM, you know, sort of 6,000 people.
Yeah.
And we played Nox Farm's Dream of Love, which is, I mean, it's 120 at double time, but you know, we went down to the boom, 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 for like, we played the whole track as well from beginning to end.
How did that
go?
That
was risky as hell, but it just worked, you know. It's weird. It just,
did people go off their mind? Did they lose it to it?
People were doing this funny like new style of dance. It's quite hilarious.
That's really cool.
Yeah, risky.
All right, cool. Let's finish up. Let's talk about your new record.
Yay, cool. Nice. Okay. So Night Whisper came out on the 1st of May.
Yep.
And yeah, so I spent like a year writing it pretty much from the beginning, which is a really unusual way to work because usually an album is a culmination, I can't even say that word right now, of years and years and years of, you know, ideas. Blah, 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 blah. But besides two tracks, this is all written within the space of 1 year. So yeah, my dad was ill and he died last year whilst I was writing it. So I
drew a lot.
Thanks, man. You know, so times like when things like this are happening, you tend to just feel more, you know,
yes,
for better or worse. And, you know, that was definitely a source of, you know, the pain. I think sometimes when you're making music, if you're happy and everything's fine in your life, you know, it might sound a bit vanilla, but if you're kind of fighting demons and wrestling with, you know, emotional issues, you know, the process of making music is almost like therapy. So, you know, you just tend to dig a little bit deeper and, you know, yes, something more honest can come out of it, really.
Yeah, so many obviously great records over the years have become because of somebody's in a bad place. And
I mean, you listen to some of the lyrics, you know, from you know, probably some of the finest records of all time, and the lyrics are quite heartbreaking in a lot of cases, you know. It's like, oh my God, this is not a happy guy or girl.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's some of the, you know, it's very, very true, really.
How did how did that process go? Like, how long did you spend on it? 12?
But I mean, last year was such a busy one for touring wise as well. So I was, you know, I was like all over the shop dealing with, you know, seeing my dad wasting away. Do you know what I mean? And just getting in the studio during the midweek when I was home and just delving in and just, yeah, using it as self-therapy, really.
That's cool. I'm glad that's nice you're able to use music as that way.
Yeah, it helps, definitely. And it's helping at the moment as well with the shit that's going on right now. It's like almost, I can find a calm place when I'm down here.
Are you making more music at the moment from this space? Or in this?
Yeah, definitely just cracking on with it, really. Just trying to figure out different techniques as well. So I've started trying to use Ableton in a, like a loop pedal kind of way. So writing on the fly as opposed to sitting down and, you know, mapping things out.
That's cool.
It's the way that Kink writes as well, you know, like sort of, you know, taking a bit of inspiration. Basically, I'm trying to figure out how to play live, in the studio. So I'm playing, it's not really, yeah. I mean, it might be something I can carry on when you start, you know, DJing clubs again. So that's kind of a skill that I'm trying to pick up and learn. But whilst you're doing that, you also figure out new ways of writing. So
yes,
that's kind of what I'm getting out of it. So it's quite nice, man, to actually make music without even looking into the laptop. So that's, you know, that's sort of one thing.
I bet that's loads of fun.
It's nice, man. It's way more enjoyable.
I bet it is.
It's really refreshing, actually. Yeah, you spend like, you know, it's just basically just figuring out new angles and getting out of your comfort zone a little bit.
Yeah, so I bet that's loads of fun.
Like, you know, I'm that guy, Mark Rubier, or Mark, is that
yes,
that's his
name? I've seen it.
You know, that's his whole vibe. You know, he suddenly figured out that he was enjoying making music when he wasn't recording music, you know, for a specific reason, you know, the actual process of writing. So, you know, the way he does it is just, you know, everything's off the top of his head, isn't it?
Yes.
Absolutely, you know. It's
and
just,
like you say, the same with Kink as well. Kink
yeah, just... completely, yeah. You can tell that they're not planning things out, they're just playing for fun. And it's, yes. This is probably one of the tips, actually, that I should have mentioned earlier. You know, if you can figure out a way of making music in you know, actually enjoying yourself, to a higher level of enjoyment, because it is really lovely anyway. You know, so I think it's standing up. If you're making music stood up, then that it brings something else. So,
yeah, I guess a lot of producers all sat down. You see, I guess
that's what I'm saying. So that's so this little area here. This is the stood up area. Like the laptop goes there. So I'm literally, you know, bashing out ideas on my feet. You know, and it feels different. And
oh, that's loads of fun.
Yeah.
You've got a lot of hardware there. If you were starting with hardware in this period, if you like your lockdown thing to learn was I'm going to buy a piece of hardware.
Yeah.
What would you start with?
Probably go for something. I wouldn't buy a vintage piece because that's still really overpriced. I mean, the prices might have come down a little bit right now, but it's, you know, the remakes are so close anyway. So probably be quite cool to buy one thing and just really just master and just, you know, just delve deep, cool. Figure out, you know, the basics of subtractive synthesis. This is going, you know, back to, you know, very rudimentary level, but, you know, understand how subtractive synthesis works, mm-hmm. you know, deeply, and then sort of, you know, take it like that. But I think Behringer have made some really good claims, and I think it's like maybe, yeah, and Korg have re-released things and stuff like that. So it's a really good time for hardware, for classics being remade. I think there's a lot of choice out there, and the prices are definitely...
Those Behringer ones are super cheap.
Yeah, completely. So I'd recommend, you know, maybe grabbing, you know, a remake of maybe like the ARP 2600 or something like that, because that was an educational tool in itself when it first came out.
Cool.
So, yeah, do that.
Okay, cool. Okay, wicked. Please, everyone, go and listen to Jody's new album. Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been so
nice
fun.
One, Graham. Yeah, man, it's really enjoyable.
Thanks for joining me. Yeah, man. And I wish your family and everyone health and in this lockdown time.
Same to you, brother.
And I'll see you soon.
Bye.
Thanks again for listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. if you have, please go, if you're listening to on Apple Podcasts, please go and give it a rating, give it a thumbs up, share it. It really helps the podcast grow on Apple Podcasts and goes help it goes up the chart, which means we can get bigger guests with bigger numbers, and which gives you more information and more tips. Thanks so much again for joining us. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll see you next time. I've been Graham Farmer. Bye-bye.